Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to Season 2 of PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an academic endeavor where we seek to understand how law is used by rising autocrats to consolidate power or by those who are trying to resist these moves. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. My guest today is Tom Ginsberg. Tom is a professor of international law and political science at the University of Chicago, where he also directs the Comparative Constitutions Project, an effort funded by the National Science Foundation to gather and analyze the constitutions of all independent nation-states since 1789. Tom has written several widely recognized books on constitutions, public law, and democracy, two of which are of special significance to the matters discussed on this podcast. How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, which he wrote with Aziz Huck, and his brand new Democracies and International Law. Preparing for this interview with Tom was a little overwhelming to me. His scholarship opens several pathways that we could chart together, and each of them would generate enough materials for more than one episode. Having to make a strategic choice, I decided to tap more on what is one of Tom's distinctive areas of expertise, and that is constitutional design, which led us to discuss at greater length how constitutional design may enable consolidation of power by autocrats, and whether and to what extent can improvements in constitutional design serve to slow or to stop these moves. You will listen to the interview after a short word of our sponsors.
Hello, I'm Tomás Díaz de la Rubia. I am the Vice President for Research and Partnerships at the University of Oklahoma, and my office is a proud sponsor of this podcast. Research at OU is thriving. Guided by OU's strategic plan, we're igniting and catalyzing research that changes lives. Learn more about our work at ou.edu/research.
Tom Ginsberg, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start this with a conversation on your book with Aziz Huck, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, which I think presents a theory about what is democracy and the ways in which democracy may die. Why don't you unpack this to our listeners?
Of course, democracy is what's called an essentially contested concept. There's like tons of different definitions. In fact, we found one article which said there are more than 500 words that have been put in front of democracy: liberal democracy, electoral democracy, constitutional democracy. So there's like a lot of conceptual confusion. So we decided to define it fairly narrowly. In political science, of course, elections are the critical characteristic. But we as lawyers, constitutional lawyers, recognize that you can't really have elections unless you have a couple other very basic rights: right to vote, right to freedom of speech, right to free organization, those kind of things which really go with elections. You can't really separate the two. So there's a certain number of rights that we would put in the definition. And then something we call the bureaucratic rule of law. And this is not usually something that scholars pay attention to, but the basic intuition is that you can't really have an election unless you have someone who's going to count the votes, according to the rules, and adjudicate disputes according to prior rules. And so that requires actually electoral machinery, bureaucracy that's neutral. And I think we tend to take that for granted in a lot of developed countries, for sure. But, in a lot of developing countries, those become very politicized. and can distort the election. So we have a thin definition. And then the question is, how does democracy, you know, end? There's a famous book by Levitsky and Ziblatt, How Democracies Die. And our point is that, you know, they don't really die so much as fade away in a very slow way. It's not like military coups are as common as they were in the 1970s and 1980s, though they seem to be making a slight comeback. This year, we've had a couple of coups. But generally speaking, the way governments, you know, fail is through slow erosion, one step at a time, using, in many cases, the law to undermine democracy.
And this is exactly one of the follow-up questions I had, because you also write in this book that law has been instrumental to both the pathways from liberal constitutional democracy that you document. In other words, that law can be used to promote the collapse as well as the erosion of democracy. Can you explain how this happens?
I think a classic studies of authoritarianism and law recognize that, you know, when you have like a military coup or even a revolution, you know, there's always an attempt to reestablish law as a basis of governance, and sometimes justify the coup in legal terms. So I think we've known about that for a long time. But what's really becoming apparent this century is the way leaders will manipulate the law one step at a time through steps that may themselves not seem particularly outrageous. But then when you add them up, they have essentially meant that the leader can't be displaced or the party can't be displaced. And they do that using legal mechanisms. You know, in the 1990s, we saw the expansion of judicial power. And many of us celebrated this because we thought, oh, judges, there's no risk. They're the least dangerous branch. You know, I sometimes say no pen, no sword, no problem. But what we've learned in the 2000s is that that very expansion of judicial power made judges a real target. And so if you can control the courts and their adjudication of issues, you can basically ensure that you're in power through nominally legal means, even if the spirit of democracy is destroyed. And I think we see that all over the place. These days, if you're an authoritarian leader and you take power, the first thing you want to do is control the courts and use the law, pass laws to legitimate your rule in ways that look facially neutral. And that combination is very difficult to fight.
But there is some of a paradox in what you're saying. If we knew, as by the way, your book with Tamir Mustafa, Authoritarian Legality, demonstrates, that courts and the legal system can be manipulated for authoritarian purposes, why did we never suspect that something like the global expansion of judicial power, or the legalization of government and politics more generally, couldn't invite the same kind of manipulation?
You know, that's a great question, Fabio. And I think the answer has to do with legal scholarship itself. That is, we were too formalist. We thought, oh, you know, the judges just apply the law. We believe that mythology, that there's no politics to law, that there's only one right legal answer, one correct legal answer, and the judges can find it. And, you know,
and the answer, if I may, is always consistent with liberal legal values. It's always going to be about political freedoms and fundamental rights.
Certainly, you know, in the 1960s and 70s and beyond, that's exactly what the idea was. And of course, that famously was something the Americans attempted to export to Brazil, to other countries in Latin America through the law and development movement. And they found out pretty quickly that whatever the power of those ideas, you know, the fact is, lawyers and law schools were embedded into prior social structures, which may or may not have been compatible with those liberal legalist values. And beyond that, I think, you know, the law and society movement, which actually in many ways comes out of that law and development movement, exposed the fact that, you know, law is definitely embedded. I mean, in the United States, we've had that idea since the 1930s, the legal realist movement that emerged then. But I think we just have now more sophisticated ways of understanding the politics of law, and I recognize that it's not neutral. But the mythology of law is that it is neutral. And that meant that we could have this myth that, oh, the judges will just decide the cases according to the Constitution, and there's no risk of capture or politicization. And of course, that's very naive. It sounds very naive when I say it. And yet there is something to the idea as well. We know that, you know, there are certain moves that are foreclosed by virtue of using law as a means of social ordering. Certain things you just can't do, but certain things you can. And in that wiggle room is where we've seen the authoritarians kind of and their legal, minions, if I can say, collaborate to exploit the holes to expand their power. That's exactly what's happened.
So why don't you give some examples of how this happens, both comparatively in the United States, which is a place where you also have a strong focus on?
Yeah, right. So obviously, I'm a comparativist. So my first, concern is looking abroad. And the very famous example, of course, is Hungary. This is maybe the perfect legal dictatorship in which, after a single election in 2011, the new party of Viktor Orban, Fidesz, basically took over the legislature with enough of a majority to amend the constitution, and they passed a new constitution, which is very different from the old. It repudiated all of the old liberal legal, cases. It sort of was, in that sense, like a legal ground zero. And through many, many individual laws, basically rigged the system in a way that it was very unlikely for him to lose. Now, in the United States, we do see something similar, which is the manipulation of law to control the democracy. And a couple of examples come to mind. One is a series of laws now being passed in the United States by American states, which are controlled by the Republican Party, to make it much harder to vote. Things like, reducing the ability to have an absentee ballot, reducing the time available to vote, closing voting booths in cities so that populations they think are going to vote Democratic have a harder time voting. You have to wait, hours and hours if you're in a city, but in the countryside, the polls are very easy to get to. So all those kind of very subtle things which are designed to manipulate. And I find those to be, an attempt through law, through ordinary law, to try to control and maintain power. Another thing that has been coming up has to do with libel law. President Trump likes, he's a very interesting guy, or he was a very interesting president, because he insults everybody. And yet, if you insult him, he's very thin-skinned. He's kind of a bully that way. But he likes to use the courts. And so he wanted, and we now have a couple of Supreme Court justices who seem to be indicating they would go along with this, to revive libel law, revive the ability of public figures, presidents, to sue people who insult them. And obviously, that's extremely dangerous in a democracy. You need to be able to criticize the public leaders, for sure. The public needs to be able to criticize their leaders and to discuss them. And if anything that's perceived as an insult could lead to a lawsuit, that's a way of shutting down the political opposition. And it looks facially neutral. Oh, everyone should be able to sue for libel. But in fact, we see that that's really destructive of democratic culture. And so that's something I see that I hear when I hear the Justice Thomas, for example, talk about that. It scares me a lot. So the elections, the libel law for sure, the media, the public sphere more generally, I think, is really important for democracy. And one thing which I've seen that your country and mine have in common is attacks actually on universities. Universities, at the end of the day, are truth institutions, right? That's our job, is to study and seek truth. We're not political organizations. And I know some professors see it differently and say, oh, yeah, we're mobilizing our power. No, our job is to seek truth. But precisely because we can establish, we have a mechanism for determining truth through the scientific method, that's very threatening to certain politicians. So we've seen the rise in, public university trustees attempting to constrain political speech and political action on behalf by their state university employees. That's a big problem. Just as we saw in Brazil, attempts to squelch Conrado Huebner, for example, if I said the name right, attempts to sue academics for what they say. And then, of course, I think in the United States, we also face a little bit of a threat from inside the university, which is basically, attempts to ensure that everyone in the university, has a common political view, actually, that are pushed basically from the political left. I think we're under threat from both sides in this regard. And so academic freedom becomes an important site of preserving democracy. And those are just some examples, but you can go throughout the system and see attempts in particular by the Republican Party when under Trump to control various aspects of democratic machinery, and then a reaction perhaps, or maybe another force, which is trying to maybe limit public discourse on many things. So that's where I think we are.
When it comes to democratic erosion, you point to two mechanisms by which somebody with autocratic leanings, like Trump or Bolsonaro, may get elected and then follow the playbook that you were just mentioning, passing constitutional amendments to redesign the government, eliminating institutional checks, centralizing power, shrinking the public sphere, and eliminating political competition altogether. The first is what you call charismatic populism, this direct connection between the leader and the people, and the second is partisan degradation, where competition among parties becomes compromised and one faction gets to dominate. I want to focus on populism here because this has been a recurring theme in our project. You argue that charismatic populists who speak on behalf of the people, whatever this is, use this status to push back against any barrier to their power, whether it's courts, the opposition in Congress, even electoral systems. In other words, these populists build in society a shared sense of institutional distrust, which facilitates their concentration of power and their pushing over of accountability institutions. At the same time, you do not ignore the fact that many times there are fractions of the people who haven't been heard or who need a voice to speak on their behalf. And maybe the fraction can be even something like 99%. So you're not demonizing populism. You're just drawing attention to the fact that populists can be manipulative and effectively use the people that they claim to represent to concentrate power. But if populism does have this potential to shed light on democratic shortcomings and to help democratize democracy, if you will, is there anything that can be done to foster synergy between populism and liberal constitutional democracy? Maybe some kind of institutional design that will keep populists within the boundaries of liberal constitutional democracy and make them rule as good populists.
Right. Obviously, populism is a recurring force in democracies, and it's a natural force. When the elites get too out of touch, then you see populist movements, and that's demands from below, usually criticizing the elites in the name of the people, and they push for, you know, more policies. And we have many examples in American history, populist movements that led to a lot of, you know, what I would say is good reforms, expansion of the welfare state. And this is true even though true populists didn't really take power for quite some time. In other words, influence the discourse with a populist movement, even if you don't actually take power. So I think populism is a necessary part and a healthy part of electoral politics. What I think is dangerous are two things. First of all, governing as a populist, right? Because governing requires institutions, and that requires understanding how those institutions work and working through them. And one of the features of what, in particular, what we call charismatic populists, a populism that is led by a single leader, is that the leader claims to speak for the entire people on his own, or it's usually his, but his or her own, personality is the only expression of the national mood. And the national mood is, you know, singular. It's not pluralistic and divided and debating. And so the leader becomes the expression of the people. And usually these leaders, like Chavez or Erdogan in Turkey, they believe what they're saying. You know, they really think that they themselves are the only one who can deliver for the people. And of course, that's never actually true. Policies can be delivered by lots of different actors. And usually policies that will help the people require complex institutional restructuring and, you know, bargaining and, you know, negotiation and actual implementation, things that don't just come, you know, from a speech in front of a microphone. So one of the things we find is that these charismatic populists are often, you know, major mechanism of undermining the democracy because they don't like institutions. They don't trust them. The institutions are something that come between the leader and the people. And the populist, charismatic populist is always distrustful of anything, civil society, political parties even, that come between the leader and the people. So they, we see and we have seen systematic attempts to undermine all of those institutions. That's why it's so dangerous. Now, what populism is good and what populism is bad? Tushnet and Bugarich have just written a book on just this point, and they like to sort of save populism. They're trying to save populism by pointing to some populist parties, the Greek Syriza, for example, that were governing mainly from a left position, but weren't really undermining democratic institutions. And I basically agree with them. That's fine. I don't see many, though, examples of charismatic populists who did not attack institutions. And that really then makes me suspicious of most populists around the world. Myself, I think they, at our moment, are something of a threat.
And I think there's something else that's troubling about populism, which is the fact that many of the populists we see nowadays, they construe the meaning of the people that they claim to represent in very narrow terms, tying the people to a religion, a race, or a set of traditional values, while targeting the groups that don't fit those identities. And we tend to look at this as merely a power-grabbing tactic, as an appeal that these leaders make to get the votes that they need to rise to power or to draw the support that they need to remain in power. But I think this has other implications that we need to study, especially from a law and society standpoint. For example, as somebody who engages in a cultural analysis of law, I think that these divisions can influence the way in which law gets interpreted and applied by courts, and change the cultural fabric that we all draw symbols from when we need to make sense of what is legal and what is illegal. But if you don't want to go that far, just think about some of the laws that the leaders pass when they are in power, which sometimes explicitly reinforce the primacy of a certain race, gender, or religious identity over others. Do you agree with me that this kind of populism, which maybe is more right-wing, can have these broader effects in the way in which, in the extent to which, law can reconfigure politics? And if so, how can we begin to trace those effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're absolutely right that there are certain cultural moves, or you might even think of populism as primarily a cultural movement and only secondarily a political one, from that point of view. And, you know, they're couched in demands for inclusion of the people, but oftentimes have defined the people in a narrow way. And so there's acts of exclusion that go along with it. Here in the United States, that has to do with the immigration politics in Hungary as well. And sometimes those are understandable and sometimes not. In the United States, you know, we have the highest percentage of foreign-born people than any time since the 1920s, I think. And then as now, we see somewhat of a backlash against it. So I'm not defending it, but I don't think it's crazy. In other words, it's an understandable political reaction. In a place like Hungary, there's still 95% Hungarian and no threat of immigration at all. And you still saw this kind of nationalist mobilization. So that's very interesting, this idea of who's in and who's out. And that is ultimately maybe a cultural statement, right? It's like, you know, we are ourselves the Hungarian people. We are ourselves, you know, the American people. And, you know, we are a distinct nation with our own history. So there's that element. Then there is, I think you very rightly pointed out that in particular, right-wing populism is associated with certain traditional values, religion, a gender hierarchy, sometimes a racial hierarchy. And a religious hierarchy, as in India, and that kind of return to hierarchy and away from liberal equality is a very powerful argument. And it roots sort of traditional small C conservatism with, to some degree, this sense that these elites have, you know, robbed us of our rightful cultural values. And so a return is really important. And I really liked your point that, you know, maybe culture is the place to understand this, because once you have a populist movement, Donald Trump, you know, came and now he's gone. Maybe he'll come back, but I kind of doubt it. But that cultural rift remains, and it shapes the next period of political development. We can't go back in history. And so now we have cultural work to do in terms of repairing the fabric and coming up with a vision of an America that is inclusive and not exclusive. I expect that the next couple election cycles are going to feature these kind of culture war type issues. You see attacks on transgender people, for example. Race is always available in the United States. And I think this is, by the way, something your country and my country have in common, which is we have many examples of multiracial democracies around the world. But in Brazil and the United States, we've seen really fast backsliding. And I don't think it's an accident that these are the two countries which had slavery, you know, as a major social institution, because it makes it very easy to mobilize fear on the part of the, the people who perceive themselves as a minority that is under attack. It's very easy to mobilize that in former slave societies.
I agree, although I think the difference between the U.S. and Brazil in this respect is the fact that in Brazil, black and brown people are the majority of the population, not the minority. Of course, just like in the U.S., they or we occupy the margins of society, and to the extent that there's a sense that they are coming to extrapolate that space that they've been relegated to for centuries, there's a backlash that happens. But I wanted to get back to our discussion on the link between this exclusionary form of populism, which sometimes builds on racial divides and hierarchies, and law. Because I agree with you that this form of populism takes the shape of a movement which gives rise to cultural wars, which has effects on political debates. But as a law and society scholar, I wonder where law fits this picture. Is it being informed by these other processes? Is it informing these processes somehow? What is your take on this?
No, you're right. A lot of times the laws that are getting passed in this regard are unenforceable. So in the 2000s, we had a whole wave of moral panic about Sharia that was pushed by Fox News and a bunch of conservatives that somewhere in the United States, they were going to establish Sharia law. And usually what this meant, to the extent there was any reality to it, is just the fact that we do, in the United States as a pluralist country, recognize private arbitration agreements amongst members of a religion to, for example, handle divorce through a religious court or something like this. We've done this forever. But, with everything going on in the Middle East, the media force fixated on this anti-Sharia thing and passed all these ridiculous laws, which are obviously unconstitutional, right? We have freedom of religion in this country. And just as now we're seeing many, many anti-abortion laws get passed that are obviously unconstitutional. So, you know, the law becomes a terrain of contestation. And it both reflects these underlying social battles, but it's also a weapon for one side against the other, regardless of what happens on the ground. It's like a symbolic and cultural weapon. The state politicians are happy that they pass these Sharia laws, and it's the same group that wants to pass the voter ID laws and anti-transgender bathroom laws that, at least in the voter ID laws, you can understand a rationale that is genuine and self-interested. With the others, it's just symbolic demonization of vulnerable populations. And so to me, it's morally more abhorrent.
That is a great insight. We can think that populist rhetoric changes culture, and changing culture causes change in law. Or, as you're saying, that changing law can be sought as another way to change culture. But let me change gears here a bit, and let me move on to what I think is perhaps the most provocative part of your book, which is where you analyze the United States and how resilient can the United States be to democratic erosion. Your conclusion is that this resilience, to the extent that it exists, is very low, that there are aspects of the U.S. constitutional design that makes it vulnerable to erosion, that even the longevity of the U.S. Constitution, which people around the world look at with great admiration, is one of those points of vulnerability. And I think this is fascinating because it breaks with a rhetoric of U.S. exceptionalism that predominates in the literature and public discourse, and which sometimes gets interpreted in very narrow terms, as if the U.S. institutions were better and other countries had to copy them. What you're saying is, no, get away from them, or, you know, be careful when idealizing these institutions. Why don't you develop these ideas further to our audience?
Yeah, that's a very interesting way to frame it. You know, when I first got interested in constitutions was the early 1990s, and I was studying democracy in Asia. And you would run into people who would show up at a country and say, you know, I know you're writing a constitution. Here's what you should do. And they knew exactly one constitution, which was the American. And even then, I could kind of sense that this was not appropriate, that the American Constitution is way too old and out of date, that if we were drawing it up now, we would draw it up in a very different way, and that it has almost no useful application outside the United States, particularly our political institutions. They're rather anti-democratic, right? We have this electoral college, which allows the minority to win presidential elections, right? You know, two out of the last five. We have, you know, the Senate, obviously, which overweights rural votes. And that's not something one would do if one was drafting the Constitution again. We also very, very dangerously give the power to regulate elections, to draw the districts and such, to the state legislatures. And that was a massive mistake, because we now can tell some states have adopted neutral electoral commissions, and we know that elections in those states are much more responsive to changes in public opinion and such. It's just a much better way to run it than to let a partisan legislature do self-serving district drawing, which is exactly what's going on right now, and which is going to help the House probably flip to the Republicans in 2022, even with a minority of national votes. So it's a bad constitution. Now, culturally, there was also this American exceptionalism, you know, in discourse, like the rest of the rules that apply to the rest of the world don't apply to us. And, you know, actually the phrase was coined in the 1930s, we learned in writing that book, you know. In the 1930s, American communists were asked by Stalin, why isn't the communist revolution succeeding here? We're having so much success everywhere else, you guys can't get any traction. And the American communists say, well, you know, we have American exceptionalism. There's something weird about this country, and it's not good soil for communism, you know, Protestant ethic or something like that. And so for a long time, we thought we were exceptional. We were immune from Europe's wars and fighting. We were, you know, God gave us this land that we have taken from the native peoples who were here before. And the rules didn't apply. We would always be a democracy. And in the one way we are exceptional is, of course, the Constitution, which, as I've said, is not a great model, but we have learned that we are susceptible to exactly the same forces of democratic erosion and the same strategies and the same tactics that are used by other charismatic populists. That's one thing we learned from Trump. We certainly are, you know, have racial dynamics, which are found in many other countries, and maybe worse here. So, you know, I think we need to, therefore, this is where the positive part of this comes in. Therefore, I think we can learn, right? We actually think about a whole bunch of institutional designs that are found in other countries that it would be good for us to adopt, and our democracy would be better for it. We do not have very good democratic institutions. They're not healthy. And that means our democracy is vulnerable. And the only way to fix it is to, you know, try some of the things which experience elsewhere has shown work. This is not new. James Madison, when he was, you know, went to do the first draft of the Constitution, got a whole collection of books that he had Thomas Jefferson send him from Paris and studied how other countries' federations had worked, because he thought he could learn from others' mistakes and others' positive experience. We have to do that now.
I also think that this analysis that you make of the loopholes in the U.S. Constitution, which can facilitate democratic erosion in the country, it rings the bell of good old days legal indeterminacy. It shows that rules and provisions alone have very limited capacity to structure society. It's the interplay between these rules and the power structures in which they are embedded that enables or constrains society from following a given pathway. You just gave an example here with electoral laws, where some states are able to conduct more neutral electoral processes with the same rules that a party uses to capture the electoral process in another state. The last part of your book presents, in fact, this bifurcation. You talk about fixes that are needed in law and constitutional design, but you also recognize that none of this is a replacement for politics. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Right. So as scholars, we like to go and examine institutions and try to understand how they work and what works and what doesn't under what conditions. That's our job as comparative scholars. And of course, there's a kind of mysterious force which is actually making the institutions work, which is democratic mobilization and politics and counter-mobilization and rhetoric, you know, which leads to shape how people understand institutional structures. And I feel like I have some competence with regard to the first. I can say a lot about institutions, but I also know that institutions can't stop backsliding, right? We use the metaphor of speed bumps. They slow down processes, but they don't stop it completely. If you have a political force that is sustained enough and powerful enough, it can go through any institution. So then the question is, you know, how does one do politics? And there I feel like I have less understanding every year. I've been studying constitutional stuff now, I guess, for 30 years. And I feel like, well, I might be finally getting somewhere maybe to understand these documents and their dynamics just a little bit. But politics, I feel like I have less understanding every year because I can't understand why some of these folks appeal. I understand in theory why someone like Bolsonaro, you know, who claims that he's going to clean the house, or Trump, who says he alone can save it and is attacking the elites. I understand why, you know, that would appeal superficially, but I can't understand why someone would sustain support for those folks after they've been shown to have implemented policies that killed hundreds of thousands of people in the case of COVID. That you know, seem to openly attack our democratic institutions. And the only explanation is that people don't value democracy or they take it for granted. They are confident that even if we lost democracy, they would be okay. They would be in the small ruling group. And that, I guess, is maybe an explanation for where we are, but I don't understand why people would think that. I don't feel like that would be true of me. You know, and I'm a white person, I'm supposed to be the part of the group that is going to run things. I feel, you know, that there's that any time I was living in a non-democratic regime, I wouldn't be necessarily the beneficiary. And I don't know quite why people are so confident. In any case, you've raised a very mysterious point on which I don't have a strong answer. I don't know how to mobilize people, but I do know that the current crop of candidates on both parties doesn't look very good. It doesn't, you know, I don't see a savior coming. And so probably that answer has to do then with mobilizing at the grassroots level and local politics, you know, and build up from there. That's actually the history of successful political parties and political movements in the United States. They start locally and build up into national coalitions. So maybe that's the big hope.
Let's talk about legal and constitutional fixes, though, in part because we're coming out of the Trump presidency, and Biden has a window to address some of those structural problems in the U.S. constitutional design. A window that may be short, since there are midterm elections coming up next year, and the president has other more pedestrian priorities, like recovering the economy. How do you evaluate Biden's performance as a guardian of the U.S. democracy, and where do you think he has to focus on to make the U.S. democracy more resilient against Trump likes or even Trump himself?
Yeah, well, I think his strategy is to just deliver. to perform and deliver and not divide people to the extent he can. And so that's what he's trying to do. And he's got a lot of challenges, and they seem to be doing okay on a lot of dimensions, but their popularity is very low, which, you know, people are in a very bad mood in the country. People are just angry in general. So whoever was in power would probably have a very bad rating. The key institutional things are to pass a national, you know, voting act and to fix the Voting Rights Act we already have, to ensure that people's, you know, right to vote, that states actually have to, and we have the constitutional power to do this, design electoral machinery to maximize people's participation rather than repress it. We could do that. And there is a bill to do it. The problem, of course, is the Senate filibuster, which is a Senate rule which prohibits legislation from passing unless you have at least 60 votes in the Senate. And of course, the Senate is structurally biased towards small states, small rural states. So that's a very hard for an urban majority to achieve, or even a rural majority. We very rarely have had 60 vote groupings in the Senate. And traditionally that didn't matter, but now we've seen that weaponized by the Republican Party under McConnell. So that basically Biden will pass no legislation at all unless, you know, the Republicans are really committed to it themselves. Well, that's an interesting thing. It's not written in the Constitution. We could change it by Senate rule. The Democrats could change it tomorrow. But Biden and Schumer, I think, believe, and I have no reason to question them, that it would be risky to change it. They could change it and pass the, you know, the democracy-enhancing legislation and pass all kinds of budgetary things that they want to do. But they worry that if they get rid of the filibuster, the next time they're in the minority, the Republicans would reverse every single thing they've done and do worse things. They'd pass national anti-abortion laws and things like this. They would pass national voter repression laws. And so in the long game, I don't see why the Democrats should necessarily get rid of the filibuster. But on the other hand, the Republicans should recognize that it shouldn't be abused. And so I don't know. This is, again, one of those political things. But I think that we're at a point where the one thing we know that would fix our democracy, we can't do, even though Biden won by 5 percentage points. And I think there are probably some people who say, you have to do it now or the democracy is going to go away. I'm not so sure of that myself. I'm not so sure of that. I think we'll survive. Certainly some American states will definitely still be democracies in the sense of majority rule. But the institutions as a whole are not doing that well.
You just launched another book which focuses on international law and how we could build an international law infrastructure that could be more supportive of democracy globally. So what is the good news that you have for us in that book?
Well, I think there's a tendency in the United States to just criticize international law. It doesn't matter. It's meaningless. It's the United Nations. You know, who cares about it? But one of the things I show is that, first of all, international law is actually good for democracies. Democracies generally are the biggest users of the international legal system, and they do it to cooperate on amazing projects. The European Union is an amazing project which requires the infrastructure of international law to execute. The Economic Community of West African States is a really incredible project. We have a bunch of small states come together, and they are regularly enforcing pro-democracy rules among their members, where if a member violates the rules, they get suspended and they come back in. The African Union just condemned Sudan for its coup. That's remarkable to me. The OAS obviously has a longer history of this and maybe a more mixed history. It's got a stronger normative commitment to democracy, but you know, in a couple of fuzzy cases, maybe the OAS hasn't looked so great. But the point being that democracy is not, even though it can only be sustained and created at a national level, still other states around can do things to support democracy. It's not you know, zero sum in that way. And so we should do what we can. We should provide technical support. We should definitely provide, you know, trade benefits to other democracies, I think, investment benefits to other democracies. And we have to speak up when democracies are degrading around the world through international legal institutions, the UN and other things. And so all of those things, I think, would help. They're not going to solve the problem magically, but they are, at least at the around the margins, will make a difference. And we do have examples where they did make a difference. One of the things I point out in the book, though, is that U.S.-China competition is going to be really important in this regard. And I spend a lot of time on China because I've spent a lot of time in China. And, you know, it's interesting. I think the Chinese government is not an active exporter of autocracy. They're quite willing to work with democracies if they get what they want and such. So I don't think this is like the old Soviet Union. I think there actually is some room, some space for democracy enhancing stuff that would not be a threat to Russia or China. And so I think there's some space there. So that's what the book is about.
I'm actually teaching a course on democratic backsliding and law next semester. And I have to confess, I hadn't included anything on international law. So I'm definitely going to take a look at that. But speaking of books, and before I let you go, I wanted to ask you to, as I like to say, open up your library and share with us the three books that you recommend to our audience and project on these issues that we have just discussed.
You know, I really like Dixon and Landau's new book on abusive constitutional borrowing, I think is the name. I think that book is quite good, a good, you know, report of where we are today. I actually think Adam Jaworski's Crises of Democracy, a very short book, is so brilliant, you know, so nicely argued. And that's one I would definitely mention as being something that everyone ought to read. Well, recent books that come to mind, actually, I really think Ron Herschel has a new book called City State, which is a very interesting book, kind of field-defining book, where he says, you know, we as constitutional lawyers haven't been paying any attention to cities, and yet urbanization is proceeding so rapidly that we're going to have many cities, mega cities of 20 million plus people, like São Paulo, obviously, but also, you know, like in the developing world, places like Lagos and such, and Cairo. These are just going to be absolutely monstrously big cities. And that's where most people are going to live. And that's where governance thus will matter the most. And I think that's something in the United States we really haven't taken to heart. So thinking about how big city government could be reflected in national constitutional design is a really interesting problem for all of us to face. And so I'd like that book a lot. I think it's great.
That was Tom Ginsberg. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Fabio, thank you so much for having me. Great to talk to you. And I look forward to seeing you soon in person.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, drop me a note at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.